As a longtime complementary medicine practitioner, I know how important it is to ensure that the supplements I prescribe are genuine, professional-grade, and effective. That's why I use Fullscript as my online dispensary, so I can send my patients as well as Intelligent Medicine listeners the exact products they need. If you're a healthcare provider, do what I did and sign up for a free Fullscript account. Just go to fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. It's the easiest way for you to prescribe the exact supplement protocols your patients need. Fullscript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. Sign up for a free Fullscript account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. That's fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're talking about how the microbiome, the critters within our gastrointestinal tract, may actually influence our cardiovascular risk. With me today is a gastroenterologist. He's assistant professor of medicine at Langone Medical Center here in New York, part of New York University. And she's a GI specialist focusing on, in particular, inflammatory bowel disease, which we'll talk a little bit about, ulcerative colitis and Crohn's. We sort of lay the groundwork for a discussion of the many ways in which the microbiome may influence cardiovascular risk via weight gain, via metabolic changes, via inflammation, via something called TMAO. Are we missing anything in terms of how it impacts that? Also, by literally, some probiotics may literally act as Pac-Men to kind of absorb or sequester your cholesterol and keep it out of your circulation. Anything else on that front?
No, I think you've hit the main point.
Here's
what we're trying to figure out is, you know, given all of this interesting findings, you know, what can we do to, you know, have a healthier microbiome?
So what's the solution? Have you developed patented and developed the ideal probiotic that will prevent us from all forms of cardiovascular mischief? Is that on the drawing boards yet?
Not yet.
Okay, I'm sorry to hear that, but you're working on it, I'm sure. You and your
colleagues.
That would be great if there was such a panacea, but I think it actually at this point, it still comes down to lifestyle. So how can lifestyle, diet, exercise, even stress reduction, how can those shape a healthy microbiome?
You know, one of the things that we touched on before was, antibiotics, you know, may be associated with, you know, disease. So one of the things that I counsel my patients on is avoiding unnecessary antibiotics. Not necessary antibiotics. Now, antibiotics are very important in terms of treating bacterial infections, but not so much viral infections, such as certain colds or, you know, certain bronchitis infections. And so, you know, I advise my patients to be careful, you know, and not take, you know, antibiotics without good cause, and also to try to, you know, avoid foods that have antibiotics in them.
Indeed. Right. So look for antibiotic free or organic on the label, because as you alluded to earlier, the study done by your mentor over there, Dr. Martin Blaser, suggests that even kind of subliminal exposure to antibiotics, not necessarily the big doses, the big guns that we use for strep throats or for pneumonia, that these will actually subtly alter the microbiome in a harmful way. So that's a good take-home message. So what can we say about diet? I mean, is there a microbiome-friendly diet that we can suggest?
Well, I mean, the studies that have been done seem to correlate, you know, this high, you know, fiber, fruits, vegetable diet with increased diversity, and, you know, a Western-style diet that has a lot of, you know, fat and red meats in it, with a lower diversity, and that, you know, we've seen in studies that lower diversity seems to be associated with more disease. Trying to eat your fruits and veggies, maybe an apple a day does really keep the doctor away.
Indeed. You know, it all comes down to that. And we just keep doing more and more expensive studies to validate that, the traditional wisdom. So is there an impact of, other elements of our lifestyle? Could stress alter our microbiome, or does exercise have a favorable effect on the microbiome?
I mean, I think there are more and more studies being done to look at that, whether or not altered sleep, has changes in the microbiome, whether or not,
sleep deprivation may change the microbiome, literally, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I think the challenging part is that a lot of the studies, so far are studies that show correlation, and mm-hmm. not studies that show causation. So that's kind of what we're looking for in the future, in future research, to help us understand how to manipulate the microbiome to improve our health.
So what's on the drawing board over there at the Human Microbiome Study at Langone Medical Center? Any intriguing studies that might yield answers on these pressing questions?
Well, one of the studies that, we're looking at, is how the microbiome may play a role in inflammatory bowel disease. And we're trying to focus on longitudinal studies, where we, take a look at the microbiome, before and after treatments, and look for, particular bacterial compositions or particular bacteria that may predict one's ability to respond to a certain treatment. And in some of our preliminary data, we've seen that there are key indices, again, diversity, or particular bacteria that may be able to tell physicians, even before a patient gets treatment, their likelihood of responding to that treatment. And so the use of, gut bacteria, not only for general health, but also as, a biomarker to help manage your disease, is something that's really being investigated and developed.
Well, as a gastroenterologist, you're certainly aware that too much of a good thing isn't good, because there is a condition called SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, and it's getting a lot of play these days, both among doctors and I think lay public's beginning to develop an understanding about SIBO. Can you tell us about SIBO as a potential cause of trouble in some people?
Yeah. So, as opposed to the large intestine, the colon, which is just filled with bacteria, your small intestine, is relatively sterile, has much fewer bacteria. And so SIBO, this condition, is thought to be, a increase in bacteria in your small intestines. And one of the most common diagnostic tests, to evaluate for SIBO is breath testing, with the idea that if you have a lot of bacteria in your small intestines, when you drink, this particular sugary solution that they give you, these bacteria will metabolize the sugars and, produce these gases that can then be detected in your breath. Now, the challenging part about SIBO is, despite having these tests, we still don't have a good idea of which bacteria are supposed to be in the small intestines. Mm-hmm. And how much, and what quantity. So it's really a disease kind of by proxy right now. We say, somebody has SIBO based off of a positive test, but even having a positive test doesn't really give us, which offending bacteria, are there.
Indeed. So we target it sometimes with a medication called Xifaxan. But in my experience, that works sometimes, but sometimes not. It's a little bit of a hit or miss.
Yeah, and again, I think that's part of the challenge is that we don't fully understand the disease, and that might be why certain patients don't respond to, antibiotics. It may also be why, certain patients have symptoms that suggest that they have SIBO, but when they do the test is negative. The small intestine, as opposed to the colon, is just a hard area of the body to sample. To get there, you either have to go through, you know, your mouth or through, you know, the colon, and, you know, you can potentially contaminate right. your sample all along the way.
Exactly. It's sort of like, you know, you can do an upper GI, you can do a lower GI, and the twain shall meet at your small intestine, which is kind of hard to get to. That's why sometimes they do the camera studies. You swallow a little tiny camera if they think, oh, we missed it on the upper and we missed it on the lower. Maybe it's in between. And then you mm-hmm. take a snapshot of the small intestine. And, of course, the diseases of the small intestine tend to be rarer than the diseases of the colon, right? Less cancer and less in the way of inflammatory disorders, maybe Crohn's disease occasionally, but not so much ulcerative colitis. Okay, folks, at this point, let's let one of our sponsors share this important message with you. Here goes. As a longtime complementary medicine practitioner, I know how important it is to ensure that the supplements I prescribe are genuine, professional-grade, and effective. That's why I use FullScript as my online dispensary so I can send my patients, as well as Intelligent Medicine listeners, the exact products they need. If you're a healthcare provider, do what I did and sign up for a free FullScript account. Just go to fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. It's the easiest way for you to prescribe the exact supplement protocols your patients need. FullScript stocks the very highest quality supplements, some of which are very hard to find elsewhere. The best part, FullScript sends out refill reminders, so it's totally effortless for your patients to stay on track with their supplement protocols. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA compliant, and they offer world-class support. Improve patient outcomes, rest easier knowing your patients are getting exactly what you prescribe them. FullScript is the most trusted source for professional-grade supplements. Sign up for a free FullScript account at fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. That's fullscript.com/intelligentmedicine. Thanks for listening and thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a free resource to you. And now back to our guest, Dr. Lian Chin. There's this, you know, while we're playing alphabet soup, you know, we talked about TMAO and SIBO. There's this thing called FMT, which is gaining some currency. And I understand, y'all are doing it over there at, in the belly of the beast at this major academic center, at NYU Langone Medical Center. It's fecal, transfer. Whoa.
Yeah. So FMT stands for fecal microbiota, transplantation. And, you know, this is a therapy that's, you know, been around for a long period of time. I mean, ancient medical texts from China talk about, you know, fecal transplantation. But it really hasn't, you know, played a role in modern medicine.
That's a certain type of soup. Recently. That's a type of soup that you can, it's really the bottom of the menu and there's an asterisk by it, I guess. You know, you only get it very, very, like in the back of a place in Chinatown. I'm just kidding.
So, you know, in ancient medical texts, it's described as a therapy for, GI, illnesses. Mm-hmm. And now it's a therapy that we use for a particular type of, infection, called C. difficile that's, been a major problem in, you know, our healthcare system in hospitals. It's a common infection. And even if you are successfully treated, with antibiotics, this type of infection tends to come back. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the fascinating thing is patients who are failing, you know, our standard medical therapy with antibiotics, and who keep, you know, getting recurrent disease will sometimes be cured with a fecal transplant. And not only, you know, is that infection, cleared, but, we break that cycle of recurrent infections.
Of course. So, I mean, that's a form of colitis. So how come FMT hasn't gained, traction in terms of treating, say, ulcerative colitis? Or even, you know, there's evidence that in animal studies that you can take a fat mouse and you give them a fecal transfer from a skinny mouse and the fat mouse miraculously drops pounds. And of course, vice versa. If you screw up and you give, a transfer from an obese person to a super skinny person who's wasting away from C. difficile, they could come back and sue you because they started gaining a lot of weight.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, what we've come to realize is while, you know, FMT is you know, somewhat of like a miracle therapy for certain C. difficile cases, it hasn't been that way for inflammatory bowel disease. And part of it is, you know, the mechanism is probably different. Inflammatory bowel disease, such as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis, it's a chronic condition. It's not a one-time infection. And so, you know, in a study that my group did in collaboration with folks at Hopkins, at Inova Health Systems, is that, you know, we studied these kids who were getting fecal transplants for C. difficile infections. But half of these kids had inflammatory bowel disease and the other half didn't. Mm-hmm. And when we looked at, you know, their microbiome before they got the FMT, you know, everybody had a low diversity state. And right after the FMT, you know, the diversity went up. Mm-hmm. But when we looked at the IBD kids, at 6 months, their diversity was low again. Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. So it seems like there's something,
there's,
you know,
some kind
about
of inertia,
the IBD. Though.
There's inertia in terms of the body's capacity to be a fertile ground for these bacteria to take root. Is that a way mm-hmm. of stating it? You know, it's not just, so I think this also explains why some people take probiotics till the cows come home and they still have a lot of symptoms. There's a certain refractoriness that some people have to colonization, even by good bacteria.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. You know, and so, you know, when they first started studying FMT for IBD, you know, we studied it the way that we studied C. diff, you know, kind of as a one-time therapy. But what we're learning is that, you know, we can't think about it in the same way. And, you know, if you want to use FMT for IBD, you may need to, you know, give it on a regular basis, you know, take medications like you would for diabetes and hypertension and these other chronic diseases. You don't just take a one-time, mm-hmm. you know, pill. You have to continue your treatment to get the effect.
Mm-hmm. Do you foresee a time? I mean, obviously, the lab over there at NYU is focusing on this. Do you foresee a time when they'll have functional probiotics, say probiotics to help support the immune system and people get sick all the time? Or probiotics that help people with mood disorders, because there is a brain gut connection, and there's some studies that suggest that certain patterns of bacteria in the gastrointestinal system are foul mood combos, and others may support healthy brain metabolism. Do you foresee a time when we actually get this right, and maybe have interventions via the microbiome to help people with a wide variety of problems?
Yeah, I mean, that's the goal. You know, like you mentioned, something that's been so fascinating about gut microbiome research is that, you know, we are finding gut bacteria that play a role in so many types of diseases, not just diseases of the intestines, but, you know, of the heart, of the brain, and, you know, nobody really wants to have to get a fecal transplant. What would be better is if we could actually find, you know, the bacteria that are responsible for these beneficial effects and isolate them, and then you could take it as, you know, a probiotic and not have to get, you know, stool.
Indeed. Well, here's the problem, though, and I think I just read a study. There was a survey of antibiotic use in the U.S., and, you know, in spite, and the major medical societies are calling for less in the way of antibiotic prescribing, yet we're hardly making a dent in antibiotic prescribing. So what do you do in your community, you know, when you, I'm sure you do rounds and you lecture with, you know, other doctors and students, people in fellowships, how do you get that message home that we may be doing people a disservice by being too quick on the trigger?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think before the medical community didn't realize that there could be so many potential bad effects from antibiotics. You know, the thought was, well, if you're not sure, maybe it's safer just to give the antibiotic, and, you know, what's the harm in that? But I think, you know, first, you know, doctors realize that there's this growing problem with antibiotic resistance. So when we use antibiotics too often, you know, bacteria can develop resistance to the antibiotics, and now we have these superbugs that are very difficult to treat, that are resistant to multiple types of antibiotics. But also, you know, antibiotics may be playing a role in our, you know, development of obesity and other diseases. And so now I think physicians, when they're, you know, considering the use of antibiotics, also evaluate the risks of the treatment. And so now we need to spread this message, you know, not only within the medical community, but also, you know, to the lay community, to the public, to let them know that, you know, there's a potential downside to antibiotics as well. So, you know, be careful.
And you as a gastroenterologist are also involved in a couple of other therapies which may threaten the integrity of the microbiome. One being, you know, maybe routine or over treatment of H. pylori. You know, some doctors I've seen test patients in almost a screening fashion for H. pylori, and then they administer a PrevPak, which is a combination of antibiotics and ulcer medication, and also the prevalent use of very powerful acid blocking drugs. Could that have a negative impact on the microbiome as well?
Yeah, so, you know, at least as it relates to, you know, these reflux medications, we know that they definitely play a role in increasing the risk of certain infections, such as the C. difficile infection that I mentioned, you know, cases of pneumonia, and that's because the gut bacteria is, you know, an acidic environment, and it does kill bacteria. And so when you take these PPI medications that, you know, reduce the amount of acid in your stomach, you're no longer getting that kind of protection. And so, yes, you know, our therapies sometimes inadvertently alter our gut microbiome in a way that may predispose us to other risks.
Well, does your knowledge about the microbiome shape your clinical practice? Are you the kind of gastroenterologist maybe a little bit a little more cautious about administering these types of therapies? I mean, there's sometimes where, you know, the best solution is a drug, but in other cases, diet modification, lifestyle modification, you know, certain natural therapies, could they obviate the potential problems that are caused by these drugs?
Yeah, I think I'm definitely much more cognizant now of, you know, the way that I use therapies, and, you know, I want to make sure that there's a good clinical indication for the medications that I prescribe. And we just don't leave patients on medications and then forget that they're there.
Indeed. So, you know, tapering off is sometimes hard when you're on these medications, but it's worth trying because sometimes, you know, I notice there's a pattern that, you know, you put patients on a medication and doctors just say, well, you know, just stay on it. You know, you seem to be doing fine. Well, maybe the original need for the medication is no longer there, and therefore a patient can safely taper. So that, you know, something I look for certainly in patients who are on those types of drugs.
Exactly, exactly.
Well, great. Okay, so you've given us a really good primer on, you know, what's happening in, you know, some of the basic science of the microbiome with practical implications for a part of the body that we don't tend to think of as being linked to our gut, and that's the heart. And I think is a tremendous insight. It's something that until recently I didn't realize until I was tasked with joining you on the podium, and I had to do my homework to sound plausible to an audience. And you certainly also did a great job sharing that information. So appreciate it very much. Thanks for joining us. And by the way, you are also in practice over there at the hospital. You see patients in New York?
I do. I see inflammatory bowel disease patients predominantly at Bellevue Hospital.
Mm-hmm. And can patients access you directly, or do they have to be referred by their doctors? Can they just show up and say, I want Dr. Leanne Chen?
Patients are welcome to contact me. My practice is essentially limited to patients with inflammatory bowel disease, mm-hmm. but there are so many great GI doctors here at NYU, and I'm happy to get people plugged into, you know, the doctor that's right for them.
Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Leanne Chen. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.